different ways. And so going back to the outline that you have right now, I was making reference to this last week. I'm just going to read what's underlined. It says, the first angel sounded, and a third of the trees were burned up, and all grass was burned up. I told you last week that this is actually has an Old Testament background for it. And this is found in Ezekiel chapter 5 and 12 on the outline. One third of you shall die of the pestilence and be consumed with famine in your midst, and one third shall fall by the sword all around you. And he says, and I will scatter another third to all the winds and will draw out a sword after them. And so this concept of a third, comes from the Old Testament book of Ezekiel. Whenever God was pronouncing his punishments upon Judah at that time, he refers to them as one third by pestilence and famine and another third by the sword. If you do not know this, the primary means through which God punishes nations is very simply in three words: famine, pestilence, sword, military conquest. This is the way in which he punished Babylon. This is the way in which he punished Assyria. This is the way in which he punished Israel in the Old Testament. This is the way in which he punished Israel in the New Testament. And this is going to be the way in which he is going to punish the Roman Empire as well. Again, going back to the outline in Ezekiel 38:22, he says, I will bring him to judgment with pestilence and bloodshed. I will rain down on him. And he talks about flooding rain, great hailstones, fire, and brimstone. And so this goes back to the fire, the hail and fire here back in chapter 8, verse 7. The first angel sounded and hail and fire followed. If you remember, I talked about this last week, the hail and fire was one of the plagues that God brought upon Egypt. And the plagues that God brings upon Egypt can basically be summarized, the majority of them, into famine and pestilence. Different forms of illnesses, whether it be the flies or the lice or the boils, all of those were plagues. And when you're dealing with famine, you're dealing with the Nile turning into blood, which removes the food from the river. And then the locust and the fire and the hail and the death of the cattle, all of those were the removal of food, which we, in one word, we call famine. Back to Revelation now on the outline, chapter 8, verses 8 through 9. And the second angel sounded, and something like a great mountain burning with fire was thrown into the sea, and a third of the sea became blood, and a third of the living creatures in the sea died. And so again, he's still paralleling the concept of the plagues of Egypt. You have where the food in the sea dies, a third of it. And so you got a third of the trees back here, a third of the grass, and now a third of the food that's in the sea is being removed. The third trumpet from Revelation 8, 10 through 11. He says, the third angel sounded, and a great star fell from heaven, burning like a torch, and it fell on a third of the river of the springs of water, and the name of the star is Wormwood. A third of the waters became wormwood, and many men died from the water. This is what we call pestilence, and that is, you're thirsty, you're going to drink the water, but the water is now poisoned. I joked with y'all last week that whenever you go to Mexico, you tell somebody, I'm going on a vacation to Mexico, invariably within the first day, somebody's going to tell you, don't drink the water. There's a reason for that, because if you drink the water, you're going to get sick. And so here is context, again, within the Old Testament times, where this is a means of punishment from God, and that is, you're drinking the water. The word wormwood literally means bitter, and that is the idea that by drinking the water, you die from what's in the water. Now the fourth trumpet, Revelation 8, 12 through 13. Then the fourth angel sounded, and a third of the sun was struck, a third of the moon, a third of the stars, so that the third of them were darkened. Going back to chapter 6 and verse 12, when you remember the sixth seal, it says, I looked and behold, he opened the sixth seal, and behold, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became a sackcloth of hair, and the moon became like blood. This terminology of great darkness is one of the main patterns throughout God's punishment of nations. This will press your mind. Can anybody tell me what the ninth plague on Egypt was? You have to go. You're probably doing it in your mind now. If you got a song that you're singing, thick darkness for 3 days, and so they're even going back to Egypt. Darkness was one of the plagues. And you will find whenever you study God's punishment upon Israel in the Old Testament, One of the aspects of that punishment was thick darkness and darkness in those days. The same thing is said about God's punishment upon Egypt and Babylon and Israel in 70 AD and now finally here, Rome. And so if you are familiar with God's punishment upon nations and all of them from the very beginning all the way to the very close is always included days of darkness, intense darkness. All right, now that was last week's class. That was why we were going at such a fast pace. If you just turn the page over, you'll have the fifth and the sixth trumpet. And by the way, if you don't have a copy of the outline, just raise your hand and I'll have somebody bring it to you. Does anybody have an outline on Revelation 8 and 9? Okay, let's see. Steve, could you do me a favor? This is 8 and 9. And we're going to, by the way, go into 10 and 11 here in a little while. But right now we're on 8 and 9. So far, basically, what we've seen is the removal of the food, pestilence, and darkness. Just keep it that simple and you won't struggle with it. What is going to follow now are going to be the fifth and the sixth trumpet. There is a great deal of text given to these trumpets. And sometimes you can get bogged down very much in the, how should I put it, the symbolism and the vision itself because of the depth of it to where you miss what it's talking about. And so I'm just going to go ahead now and read from Revelation 9, chapter 9, verses 1 through 12. Then the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star fallen from heaven to the earth. To him was given the key to the bottomless pit. And he opened the bottomless pit, and smoke arose out of the pit like the smoke of a great furnace. So the sun and the air were darkened because of the smoke of the pit. Then out of the smoke locusts came upon the earth. And to them was given power, as the scorpions of the earth have power. They were commanded not to harm the grass or the earth or any green thing or any tree, but only those men who do not have the seal of God in their foreheads. And they were given, well, they were not given authority to kill them, but to torment them for 5 months. Their torment was like the torment of a scorpion when it strikes a man. In those days, men will seek death and will not find it. They will desire to die, and death will flee from them. Okay, let's see. I'm trying to decide how far I want to go with this right now. Go ahead and drop down to verse 10. They had tails like scorpions, and they were stingers in their tails, and the power was to hurt men 5 months. And they had a king over them, the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in Hebrew is Abaddon, and in Greek he has the name Apollon. One woe is past. Behold, still two more woes are coming after these things. Okay, what is this talking about? Do you have, now this is going to require that you pay attention to what's on the table. Did you pick up the outline, Death and Hades, off of the table? If you don't have a copy of the outline, Death and Hades, raise your hand, please. One, okay. Bring all the outlines, if you will, Steve, from the table, because they're all going to be needed. What we have here is the opening of the bottomless pit. Does anybody know what the bottomless pit is and what's another word for it? Hell's another translation of it. Hades. Hades is the more accurate translation of it. I'm just going to go off on a tangent while Steve is bringing the outlines here. Let's see. From Job chapter 33, verse 18. He keeps back his soul from the pit and his life from perishing by the sword. From Job 33, he will redeem his soul from going down to the pit, to bring back his soul from the pit. All right. In the Old Testament, there was a term referred to as the pit. This is where the dead go. From Psalms 88, it says, those who go down to the pit, adrift among the dead, you have laid me in the lowest pit, in the darkness, in the depths. And so here again is referred to as the darkness and the depths, and this is where you are adrift among the dead. But it is in Isaiah 14, verse 15, where he says, "You shall be brought down to Sheol, to the lowest depths of the pit." Now, here's a term connected to the pit you're probably more familiar with, and that is Sheol. Can anybody tell me what Sheol is translated into in the New Testament Greek? Well, that's our English translation of it. Hades. Hades is the Greek of the Hebrew Sheol. Again, I'm just reading from Isaiah 38, 17 through 18. It says, "You have lovingly delivered my soul from the pit of corruption." And then he refers to it in verse 18 as Sheol. And then he says, "Those who go down to the pit cannot hope for your truth." And so all I'm wanting to show you here from the Old Testament is that Sheol and the pit are used interchangeably. And so this concept here of the bottomless pit is what we refer to as Hades, or Tartarus may even be a more accurate concept of it. Yes. No, this is not Gehenna. Gehenna. Yes, what Brother Marsh is talking about is the different terms that are translated hell. There are three Greek words that are translated hell. One of them is Hades. And then the other one, which is only used once in the New Testament, is over in Peter, I believe, and it is called Tartarus. And then you have a third term, which is actually eternal hell, and that is Gehenna. Matter of fact, Gehenna hell is what we're going to be studying in our lesson this morning in our sermon. My mind's been doing a lot of thinking this week on Hades and hell. And so right now what I'm trying to help you see is that these beings, where they're coming from, is they're being allowed to come out of the bottomless pit. And they are being told what they are allowed to do. There are limitations placed on them as to what they are allowed to do. And whenever they come out of the bottomless pit, they're told you can't harm any of the grass, you can't harm any of the plants, and you can't harm any of those who have the seal of God on them. And so there's a distinction made between those who have the seal of God and those who do not. And those who do not have the seal of God, these beings are given permission to torment them for 5 months. Not kill them, just torment them in pain for 5 months. Let's see. My mind says go to Luke. Where in Luke, though, Wayne? Excuse me, I'm going to use my computer. I'm going to cheat. Luke 8:31. There's another name for Hades. Okay, in the context here in Luke 8, this is where you have the man who was possessed by demons whose name is Legion. I'm in verse 30 of Luke 8. Jesus answered him saying, "What is your name?" And he said, "Legion, because many demons have entered him." And they begged him that he would not command them to go out into the what? Abyss. As my translation says, abyss. So what's this abyss here? What is this talking about? No, this is another term for Hades. The point I'm trying to make is Hades goes by many different terms in the Bible. If you flip over to Romans chapter 10, you find the other verse in the Bible where you find the term abyss. That's in Romans 10. Okay, here it is. Romans 10 and verse 6 is where I'm going to start. But the righteousness of faith speaks in this way: do not say in your heart, who will ascend into heaven? That is, to bring Christ down from above. or who will descend into the abyss, that is to bring Christ up from the dead. And so where Jesus descended to, and the text here is called the abyss. We know where Jesus descended to is because over in Acts 2, going off on a brief tangent here, from the Old Testament book of Psalms, you have the prophecy about the Christ that his soul was not going to be left in Sheol. When you get over to Acts 2, Peter the Holy Spirit is quoting that verse from Psalms, and he says, as David said, the psalmist said, his soul will not be left in Hades. And so again, the point I'm trying to make, Hades and Sheol are the same thing. The pit and Tartarus are the same thing. The abyss and the deep are the same thing. They're all terminologies being referred to as what Brother Marsh would describe as the storage place of the souls. And so what you have here are beings that are in the bottomless pit. They're in the abyss. And these beings are not human. These beings are probably demons that have been entrapped into Tartarus, and they're allowed freedom to come forth for 5 months. And when they're given freedom for 5 months, they're not given any permission to hurt anyone on who has the mark of God. Only those who do not have it. Now, their leader, let's get to that now, chapter 9 and verse 11, gives you some insight into this. From Revelation 9:11, and they had as a king over them the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in Hebrew is Abaddon, but in Greek he has the name Apollyon. Okay, what we're going to be doing now is having a little in-depth study of Abaddon, or Greek Apollyon. You will find when you go through Revelation that there is a linking together of Hades with something else, and that is death. For instance, in Revelation 1:18, I am he who lives and was dead, and behold, I am alive forevermore, and I have the keys of Hades and of death. So you have Hades and of death connected together. When you go to chapter 6, verse 8, so I looked, and behold, a pale horse, and the name of him who sat on the pale horse was death, and Hades followed with him. And so you've got death and Hades together. And then when you go to Revelation 20, verse 13, the sea was gave up the dead who was in it, and death and Hades delivered up the dead who were in them. There again, death and Hades. What I'm wanting to see is the coupling together of death and Hades from the New Testament. Because this helps you understand who Abaddon is and what Abaddon is. Now I'm going on the outline that I've given you to Job chapter 26, verse 6. Sheol was naked before him, and destruction has no covering. What I've done for you is I've taken the word destruction in our English and given you the Hebrew word there. The Hebrew word for destruction is Abaddon. All right, I'll see that. The Hebrew word for destruction is Abaddon. And so when we're talking about back here, the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name is in Hebrew Abaddon, his name is destruction or destroyer. Okay, from the outline from Psalms 88, verse 11. Again, this is on the outline on death and Hades. From Psalms 88, verse 11, shall your loving kindness be declared in the grave, Sheol, or faithfulness in the place of destruction, Abaddon. Again, what I'm wanting you to realize is you have Sheol and Abaddon connected. You have what we call Hades in the New Testament and destruction in the Old Testament connected. And destruction is Abaddon. From Psalms 15, verse 11. Hell and destruction are before the Lord. Okay, the word for hell there in Hebrew is Sheol, and the word for destruction there in the Hebrew is Abaddon. So again, what I'm wanting you to see is you have hell and destruction, Hades and death is the way it's put in the New Testament. All right, from Proverbs 27 and 20. Hell and destruction are never full. The word for hell there is Sheol. The word for destruction is Abaddon. What I'm wanting you to see is the connecting of Hades and death. Hades is the location. Death is the ones who are there. That's how you end up being there, is death. And so you have an angel that has power over this particular realm, and he is the one who is referred to as Abaddon. All right, now then, let's go back to some more Old Testament texts that you may be a little bit more familiar with. You remember I was asking, what was the ninth plague? The ninth plague was darkness. Okay, just see the order here. When we go back and we've been reading these plagues here from the trumpets, you've had so far hell and fire. That takes you back to Exodus. So far you've had the water turning to blood. That takes you back to Exodus. And you've had the darkness. That takes you back to Exodus. Well, what about the destroyer? Is he found anywhere in Exodus in the plagues? And the answer is yes. What's the last plague? Death. Death. From Exodus chapter 12 and verse 23, the Lord will pass through to strike the Egyptians, and when he sees the blood on the lintel and on the two doorposts, the Lord will pass over the door and not allow, notice this, the destroyer to come into your houses to strike you. The destroyer is the one that was doing the killing that night and giving limitations upon who he was allowed to kill. And so when you go to Job 15, what I'm wanting you to realize in Job 15 is, first of all, the character of the people here and what is going to be happening to the character of the people. Again, this is an obscure text. You're probably not familiar with it. Matter of fact, most of these are probably obscure text. But Job 15, now 20 through 25, the wicked man. So this is in the context of dealing with people that are wicked. Matter of fact, if you drop down to the very close of this, it says, for he stretches out his hand against God and acts defiantly against the Almighty. So in the context, we're dealing with those that stretch out their hand against God, who act defiantly against the Almighty, who are wicked men. And this is what the text says about them. The wicked man writhes with pain all his days, and the number of years is hidden from the oppressor. Dreadful sounds are in his ears. In prosperity, the destroyer comes upon him. There's the destroyer again. He does not believe that he will return from darkness. There is the darkness. For a sword is waiting for him. There's the sword. He wanders about for bread. There's the famine, saying, where is it? He knows that a day of darkness is ready at his hand. There's the darkness. Trouble and anguish make him afraid. They overpower him like a king ready for battle, for he stretches out his hand against God and acts defiantly against the Almighty. In the context here, you have basically listed all the things that are happening here in Revelation. You've got the famine, you've got the rioting and pain, you've got the sword, you've got the destroyer, you've got darkness. All of those are basically the summary of the trumpets. And these particular forms of punishment are coming upon a particular individual or group of individuals, and those are the wicked men who have their hands stretched out against God, who are acting defiantly against the Almighty. That's exactly the way it is over here in the seven trumpets. It is only those who do not have the mark of God on them that these particular beings are going to be allowed to torment with pain, and yet not allowed to kill them, but to torment them with pain. The purpose of these punishments is to get the people who do not have the seal of God on them to repent of their worshiping Satan and serving Satan and their immorality. Unfortunately, many of them, whenever these plagues come upon them, they do not repent. They do not stop worshiping Satan. They do not stop their immorality. They just become hardened in it and continue in it. And as a consequence, in the very end, they end up with Satan and his army, his followers, in the eternal punishment, which, as Brother Marsh pointed out, is not Hades, but Gehenna hell. Okay, and then one more verse on the destroyer is from 1 Corinthians 10:10. Nor complain, as some of them also complained and were destroyed by the destroyer. If you read the context there, this has to do with when the children of Israel were murmuring in the Old Testament, and God sent a plague among them, and they were dying right and left. And that particular plague is referred to as the destroyer. And so you have an individual referred to as the destroyer. And from the New Testament, we learn that what is connected with Hades is one word, and that is death. Death and Abaddon go together. The destruction and death and Hades go together. And so the name of the one who is over the angels is destruction. And again, basically, this is what's coming upon those who do not have the mark of God on them. Destruction. Okay? See, that's not too hard to see, is it? Kind of a fun study if you enjoy going to the Old Testament backgrounds. Okay, now let's go to the sixth angel. Excuse me, the sixth trumpet. Revelation 9, 13 through 21. Then the sixth angel sounded, and I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar, which is before God, saying to the sixth angel who had the trumpet, "Release the four angels who are bound at the great river Euphrates." So the four angels who had been prepared for the hour and day and month and year were released to kill a third of mankind. Okay, here we come back to the third of mankind being killed. And you have reference here to the river Euphrates. If you do a little cross-referencing with Revelation 16, 20, verse 12 at the very bottom, that's the last verse I have listed for you. Then the sixth angel poured out his bowl on the great river Euphrates, and its water was dried up, so that the way of the kings from the east might be prepared. Okay, what you have here is the idea of military conquest, the sword. I'm going off in a little bit of history. Whenever you were doing war in ancient times, one of the biggest obstacles was getting your army over the river. You may be having some Civil War buffs here. You understand the Battle of Fredericksburg and the great trouble they had there was getting the Army of the North across the river at Fredericksburg. That's always been the problem of logistics in military warfare, is getting your army safely across the river. You got to get the horses, you got to get the men, you got to get the supplies, you got to get the chariots, you got to get everything across this river. Washington crossing the Delaware. He had to get across the river, but he did it in small boats. He was smart. But anyhow, whenever you've got a humongous army, by the way, let's go back to the 16th verse of chapter 9. Now, the number of the army of the horsemen was 200 million. I heard the number of them. And so you got this humongous army coming, and it's dealing with Euphrates. Now, whenever armies would come from the land of Babylon or Syria or the Medo-Persians, they had to go across the Euphrates. And the Euphrates was the big obstacle. And so go back, if you will, now to Revelation 16, 12 and read that particular verse in mind. Then the sixth angel poured out his bowl on the great river Euphrates, and its waters was dried up. And so what you have here is the removal of the obstacle of the army that is invading to where nothing now is standing in the way. That is basically what this sixth trumpet is about, as the same thing is here with the sixth angel pouring out his bowl. And that is the armies that are going to be attacking, in the context here, Rome, they are going to be able to get across the river easily, and the consequence of that, they're going to be able to tear down the Roman Empire. Are there any, by any chance, any really big history buffs here? Okay, I'm it. Then I'm going to give you a little bit of tidbit of history. Have you ever heard about the invasion of the barbarians in the 4th century, actually the 400s, that invaded Europe from Germany? Have you ever heard of the Vandals? They were the ones that took the northern part of Africa. How about the Goths and the Visigoths? Okay. Whenever I hear those, you hear those words, you go, yeah, I've heard those Goths, Visigoths, Vandals. Let's see, I think the Franks were another group of them. And so what you have here are four Germanic tribes that basically invaded Europe in the 400s and basically took over Europe. You know, we hear the Dark Ages. The Dark Ages was the consequence of that invasion. Because that was the total final collapse of what was the vestiges, the remnants of the Roman Empire. How did they get across the Danube, though? This is a little historical trivia. The way they got across the Danube River was it froze over and they walked over it. It was the freezing over of the Danube at that time in history to where the German people could get across the Danube River quite easily because they could just walk across it like they were walking across on dry land. And that is what precipitated the invasion of the Germanic tribes into actually all of Europe, and Italy being included in it. Little, you know, tidbit of history, if you like that kind of stuff. Beginning back here to the seven trumpets and the seven bowls of wrath, it has to do with the River Euphrates being dried up and the armies being prepared now to come and attack. As he says, going back to 16 and 12, I'm just going to read what's underlined, so that the way of the kings from the east might be prepared. And so you have famine, pestilence, military conquest. That's not hard to see, is it? There's a whole lot of terminology surrounding it, a whole lot of symbolic language surrounding it. But whenever you get through all the symbolic language and you get down to the message, it is punishment from God delivered in the form of famine, the removal of the food, pestilence, and death from pestilence, and finally the sword, military conquest. That is the way God has always punished nations, going all the way back to Egypt. And as I said, you can go from Egypt and go throughout the entire Old Testament. Whenever it is the hand of God that is punishing the nation, it is always in this format. Famine, pestilence, finally followed by military conquest. The famine and the pestilence basically beat down the people to where they're too weak to stand. And then the army of the enemy is allowed to come in and overthrow them easily. All right. Any questions? Yes. I'm just a teacher. If God ever was going to tear down this nation, you would probably see famine, pestilence, followed by military conquest. I pray for God to have mercy on our nation. You know, my sermon last Sunday morning was basically a shotgun blast at how immoral we've become as a people. But again, how many people were there that had to be in Sodom and Gomorrah that God would have spared Sodom and Gomorrah? How many righteous people? 10. If there would have been found 10 people in Sodom and Gomorrah, it would have stood to this day. They were righteous. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Don't know what the population was, but I know that still, even though there is a great deal of wickedness in our country, there is still a great deal of good. The darkness is going to get darker, okay? That's just what's happening. But as the darkness gets darker, what happens to the stars? They shine brighter. If you're from California, I don't mean to offend you, but California, as long as I've known it, has been extremely immoral. And sometimes we might start thinking, well, that is the way it's going to be as far as the churches out there. If you think the congregations in California are spiritually weak because they're in California, you're dead wrong. I know many brethren in California, and I will tell you this. They are solid spiritually, and when they are in extremely dark environments, they shine more brightly and stand out more drastically than sometimes people that may be in an environment where the more of the people are just at least moral speaking. I believe that God has allowed this nation to stand. I believe that our nation stands not because of our military or our economy. Our nation stands because God allows it to stand. But I do recognize that we as a nation have committed terrible sins. And that is why I ask people to pray for our nation, that we would have a penitent heart to strive to turn from the sins. What I see is that there are a lot of Americans who have figured that out. And so I encourage you to do the same thing. Pray for our nation, that we as a nation may repent. There's a verse in my brain. Hold on. Chronicles 7:14. Really? Okay, go there for me, Jennifer, and read it. Oh, it just kind of jumped out of my head. Amen. I couldn't say it better. And so that's where I believe we are as a people. I'm sure a lot of you have friends sometimes that say, the signs are right, the Lord's coming soon. I had a friend of mine that was a barber down in Texas, and bless his heart, every time I got my hair cut, I heard this. And he would go over to Matthew 24. The problem, if you don't understand, Matthew 24 is not talking about the end of time. Matthew 24 is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. And so, yeah, there's going to be famine. Yeah, there's going to be pestilence. It's going to be followed by military conquest. Yes, yes, yes. But it's not dealing with the end of time. It's dealing with the destruction of Jerusalem. Is that the end of my class? Got 5 more minutes. If you want to, Sue, I'll give you an outline that I put together on Matthew 24, paralleled with Josephus' account of the Judean Wars and the destruction of Jerusalem. I'll be glad to give it to you. I've got it in my computer. I'll make a copy of it for you. Because if you just take Josephus' history of the Judean Wars, the destruction of Jerusalem, and parallel it with what Jesus said was going to happen in Matthew 24, they're exactly describing the same thing. And for instance, one of the things that's said in Matthew 24 is that there's never been tribulation like it before. Never will there be tribulation like it again. And so people take that term and they say, oh, this is the great tribulation at the end of time. No, that's the destruction of Jerusalem. You may not realize this. There really weren't many cities in ancient times that had 1 million people in it. The first ancient city that had a population of 1 million was Rome. During the time of the Roman wars against Judea, they understood Jewish customs of the Passover, that Jews were going to be coming from all over the world and going to Jerusalem. They allowed them to pass freely through their lands, through the armies, and they allowed them to go up into Jerusalem. And when all the people went into Jerusalem for the Passover, and it was absolutely packed with Jews, they surrounded the city then and entrapped them. According to Josephus, at the very end of it all, the Romans had killed 1,100,000 Jews in Jerusalem alone. You could not even walk on the ground anymore because there was no ground that was not covered by dead bodies. Whenever the soldiers were trying to take the city, they were marching on bodies. And there was nothing but dead bodies everywhere. 1,100,000 people, one city, nothing like that has ever happened before or since. The closest thing to it is the Battle of Verdun in the First World War. But that was not one city where all the people in the city are killed. They were all Jews. And you really want to get sick to your stomach? Read Josephus' account of the Judean Wars and the destruction of Jerusalem. I promise you, if you have nightmares, you will have nightmares after reading that. A matter of fact, Luke refers to it as the vengeance of God because of what the Jews had done. Do you remember when Jesus was being taken out to be crucified and the women were crying? What did he say to them? Don't cry for me. Cry for yourselves. Because they need to understand, they're crucifying the Son of God. And if they were going to do that, was God sooner or later going to punish them for what they had done? And the answer is yes. And when he punished them, Judea was wiped out, and Jerusalem as a nation, or as a city, was wiped out, and the temple was destroyed. I would say that was probably one of the most earth-shaking events in the history of mankind. Is that the buzzer? Okay, you got to understand, I'm half deaf in my right ear, so if I hear anything over here, I might think it's a buzzer. Okay, I'm not going to be here next Sunday. I will be in a meeting in Lindell, Texas. When we get back, Lord willing, we are going to study Revelation 10 and 11. And so make sure you have the copy of the outline of Revelation 10 and 11. If I were going to pick any text out of Revelation that is the most difficult, It's Revelation 11. But if you don't try to identify the two witnesses, it becomes a whole lot easier. And if you're not familiar with the 11th chapter, you need to realize that if you study commentaries, I've got about 20 commentaries. When they get down to the 11th chapter and they start trying to identify who the two witnesses are, it goes off in about 20 different directions. And I think when you get bogged down in trying to identify who the two witnesses are, you miss the message. And so what we're going to do when we get to the 11th chapter, we're not going to try to identify the two witnesses. We're going to try to see, what does the 11th chapter teach? What's the primary message of the 11th chapter? Okay, we'll stop right there. By the way, that outline for Zechariah and Revelation, whether you realize it or not, you should have an outline of cross-references between Revelation and Ezekiel, cross-references between Ezekiel and Isaiah, and cross-references between Revelation and Zechariah. I've got one more to give you in cross-reference studies, and that is Daniel in Revelation. If you'll take the time out to read those cross-references, it will help you immensely in understanding the book of Revelation. Okay, we'll stop right there.